Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. The United States and Russia Tuesday signed a memorandum of understanding on steps to avoid aerial conflict over Syria as both sides bomb militants. That is according to Pentagon officials at this hour. Meanwhile, Russian news agencies quoted a deputy defense minister, Anatoly Antonov, as saying that the memorandum contains a number of rules and restrictions aimed at preventing incidents between American and Russian planes. That's according to RIA Novosti. We'll bring you more details on that story as it develops. Police in the Republic of Congo fired tear gas Tuesday to break up protests against a constitutional referendum aimed at keeping President Denis Sassou Nguesso in power. Protesters burned tires and put up barricades on the streets of the capital, Brazzaville, while phone and internet services were reported to be out in much of the city. The director general of the World Health Organization says the Ebola crisis in West Africa should serve as a wake-up call for member states to do more to prevent the deadly disease outbreaks before they occur. Dr. Margaret Chan noted that 30% of staffers in a WHO preparedness division were cut after the 2008 financial crisis, and funding has remained insufficient since then. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is calling for calm during a two-day visit to Israel and the Palestinian territories after weeks of deadly violence.
Violence only undermines the legitimate Palestinian aspirations for statehood and the longing of Israelis for security and peace. The status quo is only making things worse. This conflict has gone on for far too long.
VOA News. Thousands of Syrian villagers are fleeing homes in the countryside south of Aleppo in the face of a government ground assault backed by Russian airstrikes. It's one of four major offensives mounted since Russia's military intervention in the Syrian civil war. Three other offenses are focused mainly on rural areas in the provinces of Homs, Hama, and Latakia. Over 500,000 of refugees, meanwhile, and migrants have arrived by sea in Greece this year, and the rate of arrivals is rising in a rush to beat the onset of freezing winter, according to the United Nations Tuesday. This is the UN Refugee Agency spokeswoman, Melissa Fleming.
In Greece, we have reached another dramatic milestone in numbers. Over 500,000 people have arrived yesterday, with the arrival yesterday of 8,000 people, bringing the total to 502,500.
In all, more than 643,000 refugees and migrants from the Middle East, Africa, and Asia have crossed the Mediterranean to Europe this year. Chinese President Xi Jinping addressed Britain's parliament Tuesday during a visit that the British government is touting as an opportunity for the two countries to boost trade and investment. Meanwhile, human rights advocates urge questions about China's human rights record. Earlier in the day, Xi was greeted by Queen Elizabeth Tuesday at Buckingham Palace during a lavish welcoming ceremony. The four-day trip includes talks Wednesday with Prime Minister David Cameron, dinner at Cameron's country retreat, and visits to several businessmen. Most countries around the world will need to step up their efforts to cut down on carbonization. That's according to the head of the OECD's Climate Change Division. He was speaking in Bonn Tuesday, where diplomats and experts are meeting to prepare for the UN Climate Summit in Paris later this year. This is Simon Buckle.
Overall, countries are making progress. They're making pledges that are contributing to mitigation efforts. But if they're to meet their own targets, they will need to step up those efforts. What we're seeing is that to meet the post-2020 targets, most countries will need to accelerate their decarbonization efforts.
A summit in Paris is supposed to agree to a global accord for tackling climate change in December. But last week of negotiations on the draft text got off to a stormy start, with developing nations saying their demands had been omitted. U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Joseph Dunford flew into Iraq Tuesday to get an in-person assessment of the ongoing fight against the Islamic State militants. Dunford told reporters traveling with him on his first visit to Iraq that Iraqi officials have assured him that they had not asked Russia to join in conducting airstrikes.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The worsening weather is certainly a concern because many people are making the decision they'd better go now before winter well and truly sets in. But already there have been storms here and people have risked their lives.
That's UN refugee spokesman Ron Redmond in Greece. He says weather is affecting the flow of migrants and refugees across the Aegean Sea from Turkey. Details coming up.
Also, at least three demonstrators were shot and killed in clashes with police today in Brazzaville, the capital of the Republic of Congo. And Oscar Pistorius, the superstar South African athlete, has made a surprise early exit from prison.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, more than 640,000 migrants and refugees have arrived so far this year to Europe. Most of them, more than 500,000, have taken the Aegean Sea route from Turkey to Greece. The rest have crossed the Mediterranean from Libya. Many are fleeing conflict and violence in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Others are leaving African countries and seeking safe haven in Europe. Ron Redmond is a spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR. From Athens, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the ongoing flow of migrants and refugees.
It's pretty much a never-ending flow so far. We have seen a few days when the numbers have declined. Usually it's because of increased Turkish or Greek patrols in the narrow waterway that separates the two countries, or it's the weather, and that's something that's concerning us because as the weather worsens, the dangers increase as well, and we've seen a spike in deaths over the past few weeks.
Ron, is there concern that with the weather worsening, more people will try to rush from Turkey to Greece to make it before things turn really bad?
The worsening weather is certainly a concern because many people are making the decision they'd better go now before winter well and truly sets in. But already there have been storms here and people have risked their lives. Oddly enough, the smugglers themselves reduce their rates, cutting the passage by as much as $400 for refugees who will agree to go on a windy, storm-tossed day. So it's dangerous, and it's becoming more dangerous as the weather worsens.
That's down from about $1,500 per person, no?
The average price has fluctuated between $1,200 and $1,500 per person. Some of the arriving refugees tell us they've received discounts as much as 50%.
Well, if that's the case, it sounds like many might risk the bad weather in the coming months to try to make it to Europe.
That's a worry for us because the refugees normally weigh the risks of either staying where they're at, and if they're inside Syria, it's a very, very serious situation indeed, against the risks of turning themselves and their families over to these smugglers who are some pretty nasty characters. And they weigh those risks, and obviously more than 500,000 of them so far this year have decided to take the route to Greece despite those enormous risks.
What is the latest that you're hearing regarding the bottlenecks for those who've left Greece and trying to make their way to Germany?
Bottlenecks come and go, and they erupt in various places. Here in Greece, for example, out on the islands where the refugees first arrived, we've had as many as 27,000 or more over the weekend and until today who are having a difficult time just getting through the registration system and then getting a ferry to Athens where they do their onward movement. Then there have been problems over the past day or two on the Croatian, Serbian, and Slovenian borders. It's my understanding now, the latest information we have today is that people are crossing those borders. But these blockages, these backups can occur at any time and any place. And when it does, the refugees get extremely anxious. They want to get to their destination before winter sets in. They've been traveling through very, very difficult conditions.
What are the main reasons for the blockages that you're hearing?
Governments want to try to control what's passing through their borders. Certainly, they're perfectly entitled to control their own borders. They have their own security concerns and so on. At the same time, we want to see proper reception conditions put in place along all of these borders, and including here in Greece, which is having a very, very difficult time coping with 500,000 refugees and migrants who've arrived just since the beginning of the year. But we need proper reception conditions, including shelter and health care and food and all the sorts of things that people who are traveling with next to nothing might need. And then they need to go through what can be a fairly lengthy registration process before they leave Greece as well. And so there are holdups with that process as well. The High Commissioner has been saying since the beginning of this influx that it is manageable. And I mean, when you think about it, say, for example, 500,000 through Greece, that's about 3 days passenger traffic through Heathrow. So if you've got the mechanisms in place and it's done in an orderly, organized fashion, it is possible to handle something like this, but the resources have to come from the European Union and the cooperation has to come from all European states in making this work.
Ron Redman is a spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR. From Athens, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
As flows of migrants continue to back up on Europe's eastern borders, the parliament of the Balkan county of Slovenia is voting today on whether to send troops to guard its borders with Croatia. More than 12,000 migrants have trekked through Croatia in the last 2 days, seeking passage to Germany. Slovenia complained about the surge from Croatia, which has allowed the movement of thousands since Hungary shut its borders on Friday night. The Interior Minister of Croatia says more than 240,000 migrants have flowed through his country this year. A large number of the migrants are refugees from wars in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, seeking asylum in EU member states.
The World Health Organization chief says preparedness, awareness, and transparency are at the heart of the WHO reform process. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
World Health Organization Director General Margaret Chan says many lessons have been learned from the Ebola epidemic in West Africa, and these will be incorporated in the reform process that is underway. She says being prepared is decisive in fighting any epidemic or pandemic of such magnitude. She tells VOA that involves shoring up and strengthening the resilience of fragile health systems in Africa and elsewhere in the world.
In the past, when we talk about health system, the tendency is to talk about clinical care, curative care, and now we should integrate the public health disease surveillance and laboratory testing as part of the health system capability.
As part of the reform program, Dr. Chan says WHO is building a global emergency health workforce. She says trained foreign medical teams will be on standby, ready to respond rapidly to a disease outbreak or natural disaster in any country. She says decisive leadership, awareness of the dangers posed by an epidemic, and being transparent about these problems are critical in controlling an outbreak. One of the big lessons learned from the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, she says, is the importance of building trust between the communities and health workers. She says community engagement is a big part of the ongoing work, even as the epidemic is winding down.
As we are speaking, we are still seeing community resistance. They hide cases. They continue to do secret burial. And if that is happening, it will undermine the effective public health measures.
She says Liberia has been declared Ebola-free. Sierra Leone has not had a case of Ebola in 4 weeks and is moving closer to the 42 days needed for it, too, to be declared free of the disease. But Dr. Chan warns Ebola is not yet finished. She says the World Health Organization is in the process of confirming 3 new suspected cases of Ebola in Guinea. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Swuhib, 15 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. More than 640,000 migrants and refugees have arrived so far this year to Europe. And the World Health Organization chief says preparedness, awareness, and transparency are at the heart of the WHO reform process, and would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The United Nations estimates more than 27 million people in southern Africa may not have enough to eat over the next 6 months because of poor harvests. The situation could get worse as El Niño weather patterns affect rainfall and crop production. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
The 2 UN agencies, the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, and the World Food Program, WFP, say drought and flooding over the last growing season are to blame for the current food shortages in southern Africa. The threat is most severe for Malawi, Zimbabwe, and Madagascar. Chimimba David Piri, FAO coordinator for Southern Africa, says the number of food insecure people has increased 13% compared to a year ago. He says the severe El Nino weather patterns forecast for the region won't help matters.
So we do expect that certain parts of the sub-region will have normal to below normal rainfall. Should it be below normal rainfall, then we can expect a further problem, reduced production for a second season running. I hope it does not come to that. If it does, then the numbers of food insecure people are going to increase, because even those people that were resilient this year will fall into food insecurity next year.
The UN relief agencies say Tanzania is the lone country in the region that produced enough in the 2014-2015 season to meet its needs. South Africa and Zambia will not need to import food only because they have enough in their stocks. The rest of the region will have to rely on imports or international aid. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Truck drivers in Cameroon are again refusing to transport food and humanitarian aid to the troubled Central African Republic. They say UN peacekeepers in the CAR are not able to provide adequate security. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Douala Seaport in Cameroon, the starting point for goods headed to the landlocked CAR.
Driver Ibrahim Suli says for 2 weeks now, he has been waiting with his cargo for assurances from the truck drivers union.
Je ne peux pas. Si on va en Afrique centrale, on va mourir. Les rebelles sont présents et on.
He says he is not ready to go to CAR because armed men have been attacking the trucks and the UN peacekeeping forces are apparently helpless. In August, Cameroon and CAR officials met in Yaoundé to plead with truck drivers to resume transporting goods and humanitarian aid after the drivers complained that 18 of them had been killed. The drivers said they are constantly harassed in the CAR on the corridor linking Bangui to Douala. The CAR's transport minister, Arno Jubaye Abazeni, assured drivers that UN mission in the country, known as MINUSCA, had agreed to protect them. President of the Drivers' Union, El Hajj Umaru, says insecurity remains.
Disons que au niveau du corridor Douala-Bangui, il se trouve que depuis quelques semaines, on a déjà.
He says within 1 month they have reported 2 deaths, several vehicles destroyed, food and equipment seized, and a few drivers held hostage by the armed groups. Cameroon's transport minister Mbengo says the economies of both countries are suffering. He says he is worried about increased congestion at the Douala seaport.
Les compteurs sont remis à zéro. C'est ce que je considère parce que je suis face à un nouveau grand défi.
He says it is a new challenge that has to be handled tactfully. He says he is very confident that Cameroon and CAR officials will find solutions to the new challenges in a not too distant future. The Central African Republic's interim president, Catherine Samba Panza, cut short her stay in New York for the UN General Assembly last September 30 as violence resumed in Bangui. CAR depends on the Douala Road transport corridor for 90% of imports and exports. All of the humanitarian aid and supplies from MINUSCA transit through Douala. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Douala, Cameroon.
The UN Security Council today has condemned intercommunal fighting in the Central African Republic that has targeted civilians and particularly women, children, and UN peacekeepers. Intercommunal violence has plagued the country since 2012 when Muslim militias conducted a coup. Christian militias responded with increased violence that caused widespread displacement of civilians. The violence picked up again in recent weeks, especially in the capital, Bangui. Despite the security concerns, the Vatican in Rome announced that Pope Francis will make a 2-day visit to the country. The major focus of his visit will be a meeting with Muslim leaders at the capital's Kadoukou Mosque. The council repeated its support of the government of interim president Catherine Samba Panza. The council also threatened that anyone found undermining the country's peace and stability faces travel bans and freezing of assets.
At least 3 demonstrators were shot and killed in clashes with police today in Brazzaville, the capital of the Republic of Congo. Protesters began street demonstrations today to protest against the referendum election on Sunday. It would permit Congo's president, Denis Sassou Nguesso, to run for another 7-year term in office next year. Mr. Nguesso, who is now 70, proposed the referendum to eliminate the 70-year age restriction and a 2-term limit. The president had served as president for 30 of the country's last 36 years. Most businesses are closed in Brazzaville and some telecommunication systems are not in operation. Today, police have fired warning shots and tear gas grenades at crowds of youth who erected barricades and burned tires in several neighborhoods. A Reuters reporter saw the bodies of 3 protesters at the city's central morgue.
Oscar Pistorius made a surprise early exit from prison late yesterday, getting out a day before he was supposed to be released on parole. The superstar South African athlete shot from fame to notoriety when he was convicted in 2014 of shooting dead his girlfriend. VOA's Anita Powell has followed the story from the beginning and brings us the latest chapter from Johannesburg.
Oscar Pistorius's family says his release from prison does not mean freedom, but rather a move to another sort of prison. For the remaining 4 years of his 5-year sentence, the athlete will be confined to his uncle's Pretoria mansion. Family spokeswoman Annalise Burgess spoke to a media scrum gathered outside the Pistorius home Tuesday morning. She confirmed he was inside the house.
The family is happy that Oscar's home, but they want to make the point that Oscar's sentence continues. And that is the key point here. His sentence isn't shortened, it hasn't been reduced. He continues to serve his sentence as per the sentence handed down by the trial judge.
He will also be required to undergo psychotherapy and community service. The icon-turned-inmate was due to be released Tuesday, having been granted parole after being convicted of culpable homicide, equivalent to the U.S. charge of manslaughter, for killing his girlfriend, model Reva Steenkamp, at his Pretoria home on Valentine's Day in 2013. But correctional officials, in an apparent attempt to avoid the media frenzy that has trailed the runner since his shocking arrest and hotly followed trial, quietly released him from Pretoria's Nkosi Mampuru II prison Monday night. Under cover of darkness, the Olympian, who made history in 2012 as the first double amputee to participate in the Olympics, was driven to his uncle Arnold Pistorius's large home in the wealthy Pretoria suburb of Waterkloof. South Africans raced to social media platforms to weigh in on Tuesday. Reactions ranged from support to indifference to outrage. Steenkamp's family has maintained that the 5-year sentence was too lenient. Pistorius claims he mistook Steenkamp for an intruder when he shot 4 times through a locked bathroom door, killing her. The prosecution argued, unsuccessfully, that Pistorius intended to kill Steenkamp when he shot 4 times through a locked bathroom door. But this release to the comforts of home and family is hardly the finish line for Oscar Pistorius. He has been banned from international competition for the duration of his sentence, and the prosecution is appealing his verdict on November 3rd. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa. Host Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the upcoming elections in Africa and consider what makes an election credible to the extent that it reflects the will of the people. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing. So definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America, VOA.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. More than 640,000 migrants and refugees have arrived so far this year to Europe. The World Health Organization chief says preparedness, awareness, and transparency are at the heart of the WHO reform process. And at least three demonstrators were shot and killed in clashes with police today in Brazzaville, the capital of the Republic of Congo. Coming up, music from Sierra Leone. And in our feature segment, a nonprofit group that breeds more nutritious plants and shares them with Africa and the world. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Of course, it's time now for sports with the mighty, mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sonny Young. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Well, Kim, we start off in Zurich at the FIFA headquarters.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much. The World Football Governing Body, FIFA, has confirmed it will hold the election for its next president at a special congress on February 26th. The election will determine who will succeed Sepp Blatter, who has been president since 1998. Blatter and Vice President Michel Platini have both been suspended for 90 days amid corruption allegations, which both men deny. Platini is seeking the next presidency, though, as is Prince Ali bin Al Hussein. Platini, who is president of European Football's governing body, UEFA, submitted his candidacy papers earlier this month, but FIFA says it cannot recognize his candidacy while his ban is in place and he cannot campaign. However, FIFA's electoral committee says it may allow him to stand if his suspension ends before the election date. Sheikh Salman bin Ibrahim Al Khalifa of Bahrain is expected to contest the election. Others are former Trinidad and Tobago midfielder David Nakhid and ex-Tottenham defender Romano Vega. Swiss Blatter is under criminal investigation over claims he made a £1.35 million payment to Platini in 2011, as well as allegations he signed a contract unfavorable to FIFA. And now let's go to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma. Hello, Mark.
We begin with football. Saad Guir scored in the 75th minute to lift the hosts Tunisia to a 1-0 triumph over defending champions Libya in their African Nations Championship qualifier in Tunis on Monday. In Chile, Croatia pipped South Africa 2-1 at the FIFA Under-17 World Cup in Concepcion on Monday. Today, Tuesday, Guinea plays South Korea in La Serena as defending champions Nigeria face hosts Chile in Viña del Mar. Meanwhile, hosts Ethiopia and Burkina Faso drew 0-0 in the return leg of the Africa Women's Under-20 World Cup qualifying at Addis Ababa on Sunday. Ethiopia advance on a 2-0 aggregate. They face Ghana as South Africa engage Nigeria in the other encounter to determine the two teams that will represent Africa at the global contest. In cricket, Uganda lost by 138 runs to Ireland at the ICC Cricket World Cup qualifiers in Pandaramaran, Malaysia on Monday. Turning to athletics, Kenyan defending champion Abraham Cheruben won the Valencia Half Marathon in Spain on Sunday. Cheruben's winning time of 59 minutes and 10 seconds is the world's quickest time in the event this year. Ethiopian Netsanet Gudeta won the women's race in a personal best and a new course record of 1 hour 7 minutes and 30 seconds. In Portugal, Kenyan Asbel Kipsang triumphed at the Rock and Roll Marathon in 2 hours 9 minutes and 26 seconds in the Portuguese capital Lisbon on Sunday. Kenyan Purity Rionoripo prevailed in the women's race in 2 hours 25 minutes and 9 seconds, while Eritrea's Nguse Amlosom and Kenyan Beatrice Mutai won the men's and women's half marathon races respectively. Finally, in Canada, Kenyan Ismail Chemtam clocked 2 hours 9 minutes to win the Scotia Waterfront Marathon in Toronto on Sunday. Ethiopian Shume Demise triumphed in the women's race in a time of 2 hours 23 minutes and 37 seconds.
That was Mark Ouma reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Thanks, Mark.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America!
This weekend, it's the second leg of the final qualifying round of Orange Africa Nations Championships qualifiers, Rwanda 2016. I reached our African football guru, David Legg, in Johannesburg, South Africa. So, David, exciting qualifiers.
Right, Douglas. It's the first round, first leg matches, and at stake here for the winners are places in the finals in Rwanda, which will be next January and February. And a reminder to all our VOA listeners that the African Nations Championship is the competition for home-based players. So the European stars are excluded from this competition. And something else that's different from the Cup of Nations is that the qualifiers are based on regions. And if we start in the West Zone A, in Bamako, it was Mali 2, Mauritania 1. And then again in Bamako, unfortunately, because of the Ebola epidemic, Guinea have to play their home matches there. It was Guinea 2, Senegal 0. We then move on to West Zone B in Kumasi in Ghana. It was Ghana 2, Ivory Coast 1. That was a big match of the weekend. And then Port Harcourt in Nigeria, Nigeria 2, Burkina Faso 0. In Niamey, Niger 2, Togo 0. Down to Central Africa, in Yaoundé, Cameroon 0, Congo Brazzaville 0. In Jemena, Chad 0, Gabon 2. The Democratic Republic of Congo received a walkover because the Central African Republic did not have the funds to fulfill their fixture. In a region called Central East, in Kampala, it was Uganda 2, Sudan 0, and in Bujumbura, Burundi 2, Ethiopia 0. And then down to the southern region, three matches in Bulawayo in Zimbabwe, Zimbabwe 3, Lesotho 1. At Indola in Zambia, Zambia 3, Mozambique 0. And in Johannesburg, South Africa 0, Angola 2. And the return matches will be played on the weekend of October 23, 24, and 25. As mentioned, the real attraction of the weekend was undoubtedly Ghana against Ivory Coast, two of the top three ranked nations in Africa. And from that game emerged a very unlikely star. It was Joel Famaye. He plays for a second division club in Ghana. People basically had never heard of this player, especially in the Ivory Coast. And the Ivorians were sitting pretty when Sangare scored after 31 minutes for the Elephants. But Famaye showed his prowess in the penalty area by equalizing just on the stroke of halftime. And then at stoppage time at the end of the match, he struck again. That's a slender lead for Ghana, who have competed in all three previous CHAN competitions. In fact, they reached the final on two occasions. In 2009, they lost to DR Congo 2-0. And much more recently, in 2014 in Cape Town, they drew 0-0 with Libya after extra time in the final, but the Libyans emerged victorious on a penalty shootout. There were a lot of home victories. If you look at the Western area, Mali, Guinea, Nigeria, and Niger all winning at home. In Central Africa, disappointment for Cameroon, though. An ultra-defensive Congo-Brazzaville side went to Yaoundé and restricted the Cameroonians to very few clear-cut chances. The Congolese will be more than happy with a 0-0 draw. Trouble, unfortunately, in N'Djamena. The Chadian fans were very disgruntled with the performance of their side and started hurling water bottles onto the field near the end, but it didn't prevent Gabon coming away with a 2-0 victory. In the central region, good home wins for Uganda and Burundi because they both won by 2-0, but very importantly, did not concede goals at home. And my prediction there is if that Burundi and Uganda can score away goals this coming weekend, they should progress to the finals. Zimbabwe, another side that have been ever-present at the CHAN finals. Good 3-1 home win there in Bulawayo over Lesotho. That should be enough to see them through to the finals. South Africa paid the price for fielding a makeshift side at home to Angola. The Angolans scoring twice in the second half. And you'd only be a very brave South African if you felt that they could now reach the finals. I think one of the bankers to get there will be Angola. Douglas?
Thanks, David. That was our African football guru, David Legg, reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. And just before we go, Nigerian striker Emmanuel Emenike has retired from international football. The 28-year-old, who plays for Al Aini of Dubai, has not scored for the Super Eagles since October 2013. Emenike, the second player to announce his retirement from Nigeria's senior squad this month, following Lille goalkeeper Vincent Enyema, Nigeria's most capped player, who quit after a much-publicized row with coach Sunday Oliseh. Olisha was reportedly considering leaving out Emenike for next month's World Cup qualifier against Swaziland because he has not scored at international level for 2 years. Emenike made his international debut in a friendly against Sierra Leone in Lagos in February 2011 and was top scorer at the 2013 Africa Cup of Nations, helping Nigeria lift the trophy. He made 37 appearances for the Super Eagles and scored 9 goals. And that's it for this edition of the Sunnyside of Sports. I'm Douglas Impuga. Sunny Young will be back tomorrow. Now back to you, Kim.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunnyside of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunnyside of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a nonprofit group breeding more nutritious plants to share them with Africa and the world. And next, educating women in South Sudan. But first, some music. Here is Alonzo of Sierra Leone with We Wanna Know.
Now what in the happen, no? Now what in the happen, no? In this land, hey, what in the happen, no? Africa, what in the happen, no? What in the happen, no? We want to know, hey.
We want to know. Why the system just they go slow? We want no home. Why we still live bampo? We want no home.
Africa,
by all we natural and mineral resources. We want no home.
Africa,
why we still live for losses. We want no home.
Yeah.
We want no home.
We want no. We want no.
As an African, I'm so proud of identity, yeah, but I'm so hurt for seeing me people and they live in poverty, yeah. How long, man, then go to live like this, yeah. We struggle so hard, but we still
can't find no peace. Yeah. Go to Sudan and see how so many people them they suffer. Yeah. Come to Liberia, some man and tin for it now a holla. Inside Salome, then just left we own. We got and just they eat the beef and they left the with the bone. So we want no home. Who side all we money they go? We want no home. Who side the African money they go? Hey. We want no home. Who are the system just they go slow? We want no home. Who are we still they live bampo? We want no home. Africa, by all we natural and mineral resources. We want no home. Africa, who are we still they live for losses? We want no home. This message to all the presidents, yeah, of this our lovely African continent, yeah. I wanna know who, what's going on in Africa. I see so many dying, so many people am crying. Upon all the riches where we get, Africa still needs help. And when
Alonso of Sierra Leone with We Wanna Know.
While governments, NGOs, and scientists have worked for decades to end hunger and malnutrition by increasing the quantity of food grown, today they are trying to improve the nutritional quality of food. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with economist Howard Buis, the director of Harvest Plus, a nonprofit group that breeds more nutritious plants and shares them with Africa and the world.
Our target is to improve mineral and vitamin intakes. And what distinguishes us is that we're breeding plants to put more minerals and vitamins in the food staples that the poor eat day in and day out.
You're actually creating new kinds of plants, right?
Yes. The way I express it is that we're getting the plants to do the work. There are a couple of advantages using the plant breeding strategy. The first is that we start with the smallholder farmers who are growing the crops that they eat. And when you have the fortified foods that are made in the factories, they often don't reach the rural areas. The second is that it's cost effective. By getting the plants to do the work, once they're in the food system, you don't have recurrent costs. So essentially, the vitamin A and the iron and the zinc is coming free to the households.
Now, is this the same as so-called genetically modified crops?
It's not. We're using conventional plant breeding. We're just crossing high-yielding varieties with the high-nutrient varieties and getting high-yielding, high-nutrient varieties so that we're not using the GMO technology at all.
What is your approach in terms of getting traditional farms to use this? Are there any challenges in terms of getting people on board to actually plant these plants?
Well, we really have two messages for the farmers. The first is that our crops are just as high yielding and just as productive, so you're not sacrificing profits from the crops. They can also be sold in the market. Farmers are always looking for that. But then you get the added value of the extra vitamins and minerals in the crops.
Let me see if I understand what Harvest Plus does more carefully. Is it that you develop these things or you just sort of advocate for them? I mean, what is your involvement in it? A lot of people obviously are in the business of trying to make food more nutritious.
Well, the plant breeding process takes a while to develop the crops. To do the crossing to get the high yields and the high minerals and vitamins in the crops is an 8 to 10 year process to develop them. Then once they're approved for release in the countries, now we're involved in the job of getting them out to farmers and scaling up. We have the varieties now released in 28 different countries around the world. Now that we're getting the crops out to farmers, we're partnering with NGOs to take our crops and incorporating them in their programs of the NGOs in reaching out to farmers in developing countries. What we're doing now is quite a bit different than when Harvest Plus got started in 2003. So in the beginning, we had to prove that we could develop these crops in high-yielding backgrounds. There was some doubt about that, and we released our first varieties in 2012 in Africa. We also had to do nutrition studies. We had to prove that when vitamin A deficient, iron deficient, zinc deficient people ate our crops, that we could improve their mineral and vitamin status. And now we've done those nutrition studies, and we've convinced the nutrition community that we can make a significant contribution to reducing mineral and vitamin deficiencies. Now, in the last 2 or 3 years, now that the crops are released, our focus is on extension to farmers and convincing consumers to eat these crops. So we're really into delivery and scaling up now. The governments are really quite excited. Initially, we chose target countries where we introduced a single crop. And in every case, the governments have said, why aren't you bringing all your crops to our country? Why are you just bringing a single crop? It's really gratifying to see all this time and effort that's gone into this starting to have some real impact.
That was Howarth Buis, director of Washington, D.C.-based Harvest Plus. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips.
Female students are part of the small percentage of students in South Sudan schools. Many of them argue that educating women is a lifetime investment for the people of South Sudan. Philip Tonaliu visited the Health Sciences Institute in the capital, Juba, and has this report.
Charity Akujo is a first-year student of clinical medicine at the Health Sciences Institute in Juba, who enrolled at the institute after completing secondary school. Akujo says educating mothers have many advantages over their illiterate counterparts.
When a lady is educated, she is able to bring up the children because she knows what it means by bringing up children in a good way. You balance the nutritional status of these children. Secondly, you also make sure you maintain the children by preventing some diseases. Like at home, you know the cause of malaria and how it can be transmitted. This one at home, you can be able to prevent by sleeping under the mosquito net.
Akujo considers herself lucky in a country where an adolescent girl is 3 times more likely to die during childbirth than complete primary school. According to statistics released by an education division of UNICEF in 2013, only 7% of South Sudanese girls are able to complete the 8-year primary school cycle, and only a little over 1.5% of some 420,000 girls between the ages of 14 and 17 who complete primary school ever enroll in secondary school. 29 of the 128 students in Akujo's Faculty of Clinical Medicine at the institutes are girls. Akujo believes when a girl receives an education, she can overcome many obstacles put in her way, such as programmers' marriages, which are fairly common in South Sudan.
For us women, you may get married to somebody who have got 2 to 3 women. And if you are educated, you'll be able to work and you get your own money. In that way, you can be able to support your family, much as the husband is giving the support to all of you, but you can still be able to help your children.
On Tuesday, South Sudan joined the rest of the world to mark the 4th anniversary of the International Day of the Girl under the global theme, The Power of the Adolescent Girl, Vision for 2030. It calls on the international aid groups, governments, and other stakeholders to redouble their efforts to empower adolescent girls as part of the UN's Sustainable Development Goals. Adolescent girls are among the most marginalized and neglected groups in the world, according to the UN. Many girls are subjected to child marriages, unwanted pregnancies, sexual transmitted diseases, and gender-based violence, all of which have long-life consequences. Lucy Fikra, another student at the Department of Clinical Medicine at the Health Science Institute, says South Sudanese schoolgirls face many challenges as well.
When I go from here, I tend to work, overwork at night. I'm tired, I cannot study. Then I end up sleeping, and if I don't struggle, and if these girls, if they don't struggle very well, they will perform poorly. And when you fail like twice, you end up giving up and you decide to get married.
But Fikra says she will not give up because she's determined to reach her goals.
After finishing from here, I will know how to space my children. This is a big challenge in South Sudan. There's high rate of what? Malnourished children, and it's due to no proper spacing.
Kujo says in order to realize those goals, parents must give both their boys and girls equal opportunities to education.
In other countries, they make sure all children are going to school, whether male or female. So in that case, South Sudan should also make sure they encourage their children to go to school, because in order to bring South Sudan out of this ignorance and out of these problems, all children have to go to school.
The young women here at the Health Science Institute are not all certain that most South Sudanese children will get an education, given that many parts of the country have been destroyed by the 20 months of conflict. But Fikra and Akujo say they are optimistic. Girls can achieve what they are after if they do not give up on their dreams. South Sudan Ministry of Education officials said during a celebration marking the International Day of the Girl on Monday that the girls' education strategy launched earlier this year will increase girls' enrollment in and completion of primary and secondary school. For VOA News, I'm Philip Tonaleo in Juba.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a ceremony attended by U.S. Ambassador Eunice Reddick and Deputy Minister Kafa Rekiatu Christel-Jaku, the governments of the United States and Niger officially signed the Security Governance Initiative Joint Country Action Plan on October 9th. The Security Governance Initiative, or SGI, represents a comprehensive approach to improving security sector governance and was launched last year with six partner countries, Ghana, Kenya, Mali, Niger, Nigeria, and Tunisia. SGI will focus on civilian and military security institutions and the ministerial functions that provide state oversight of the security sector. SGI programs will differ in each country, reflecting specific partner country challenges, goals, and objectives. The SGI approach is based on partnership and joint analysis of the opportunities and challenges governments face and entails whole-of-government strategies to achieve catalytic and systematic reform in specific areas of focus related to the functioning of civilian and military institutions. Through the SGI, Nigerian and U.S. experts have worked together to develop a Joint Country Action Plan, or JCAP. The JCAP is a shared document that outlines a roadmap for a successful partnership under the SGI and identifies three focus areas: developing a national security review and strategic framework, aligning existing human and material resources more efficiently to address short and long-term security needs, and external communications. SGI is a distinctive approach. Its key goals and objectives are to increase partner nation capacity to meet citizen security needs, prevent or mitigate instability and conflict and counter-terrorist activities and their enabling environments, promote democratic governance, rule of law, respect for human rights, and long-term economic development, and deepen the impact of U.S. investments in countries that show leadership and political will to make reforms and policy decisions necessary to improve security sector governance. Following the signing of this important document, the governments of the United States and Niger began developing activities to support efforts in the three focus areas. SGI teams will be visiting Niger later in October and in late November to begin this engagement. Niger and other African nations in the region face new security challenges. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Niger, to help meet these challenges and to meet the security needs of the people of Niger.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Straight Talk Africa. Host Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the upcoming elections in Africa and consider what makes an election credible to the extent that it reflects the will of the people. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.